Commissioner Cooley?
Here.
Commissioner, Chair Ekstrom?
Here.
Commissioner Finch? Commissioner Kilkenny? Commissioner Killian?
Here.
Commissioner Peterson? Commissioner Smith?
Here.
And Commissioner Thompson?
She was, isn't Ion Liz?
Yes.
Yeah, probably.
Yes.
Okay. Pledge allegiance.
Is this being recorded?
Yes.
Is it?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Everyone had a chance to review the minutes.
Which one do you want it, cloud or computer?
With no changes?
Recording in progress.
Sorry.
Except the minutes as. And again, thank you for, the minutes are great, so I appreciate that. Today is a little bit different because we are in a work session. We don't have any public, we don't have anybody to go through my whole spiel with. So what we'll do is Daisy has put together a PowerPoint for us. And what we'll do is have her go through the commission. We can ask questions as we go. We will at the end then go and ask the public or on Zoom. So that way we get through it and then those questions can come up there.
And Daisy and I went over it today, also with Dan Kearns, our legal counsel, who had a conflict, apparently a jurisdiction more important than ours. Actually, they had some pretty tough issues, so we gave them the pass.
Okay.
I might interject a little bit. And at the Planning Commission, if you have questions, please ask. But it starts to make a lot of sense about halfway through. We've been working on this for the last couple of months, so. Anyway,
there's a lot here, but we're trying to definitely make it as straightforward and easy to understand as possible. It's a huge objective of this, is just to make things clear and objective to the extent that we can, and then where people can really understand what the code requires and when different things are triggered. So please don't hesitate to jump in and interrupt me if things aren't clear so that we kind of know where the like issues are or where there's things that just don't make sense.
Did we make copies of the PowerPoint?
Yeah, I left them on the... On the planning calendar.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Steve.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna guess, Pfeiffer.
Yep, just like that.
Carolyn. Is that it?
Okay.
I'm joining a couple of minutes late, so sorry, but I'm here now.
Welcome, Commissioner Kilkenny. Can you move the...
Yeah, we're just trying to get who was here so I can write it down. Sorry.
Not trying to... So we'll just get...
I got the monitor and see someone.
Single person. Okay.
He's the worst one.
It's funny. I thought it was like a horse's nose. There you go.
It goes to whoever's talking.
Oh, really?
Alrighty, can you hear us, John?
Oh, because he was making noise.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
All right.
Awesome.
I think we're good.
Okay, perfect. So this, again, it's a work session. This isn't meant to be a final product. There's definitely things we want to work through and really... areas where we want to have revisions and input, and that's what the process is for. And so please let us know what direction we should be going in on some of these things or what questions come up for you as we go. So my first slide, Landon, this is an overview of like the 8 broad categories of amendments that we're going to be covering. So we'll go through each one slide by slide and give you guys an opportunity to participate and make recommendations and ask questions. But the 8 broad categories that we are focusing on is, number one is the separation of the administrative process from the ministerial process, and we'll get into what that means. The clarity and consistent terminology when we're so that our language isn't conflicting and it's not inconsistent. Number 3, amending section 10.030 to reference the code enforcement ordinance. Number 4, allowing the conversion of some existing dwellings on that are currently on EFU land to non-farm dwellings. So if you're retiring, you can convert it and do estate planning. Number five, specifying vesting requirements and extension processes that aren't necessarily super clear right now. Number six is considering changing the comment period and appeal period. And number seven is the, we're just going to discuss the CUP process and get into how those are done through the quasi-judicial process. And then number eight is just a few other kind of assorted amendments. I don't really have a category. So this, yeah.
And just the one last piece. On the parts where we want to dive down into more detail, I can take over the keyboard and we can pull up the Word version and just wordsmith it.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to get to that level of detail, that's okay too. But that we can use that tool.
Yeah. It's a work session.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so the for starters, I wanted to break down the ministerial process and the administrative process. These you guys should have received in your packet on page 8, this breakdown, and it's just available on the next slide, so we can go through it in a little more detail, of the different application types and processes. And the two we're focusing on today is ministerial and administrative. So a ministerial permit is not a land use decision. It's a building permit, a land use compatibility statement that we just sign off on. The idea of a ministerial permit, the way that the state defines it, are they're decisions that are made without notice, without hearing, and they must be only made using clear and objective standards. So anytime we introduce subjectivity, where if you put 10 people in the same room and they would read it differently or have a different interpretation, then it cannot be processed ministerially. It becomes a land use decision, and it requires us to send out notice and provide an opportunity for the public to comment. The administrative process isn't a huge hurdle. It's fairly straightforward. It's a really basic process where we send out notice, provide findings, basically explaining how we got to the approval that we got to. And then we provide the public with an opportunity to appeal it or request a hearing. And anything that requires any level of discretion or professional interpretation is required to be processed through an administrative procedure. Examples of this are land partitions, minor variances, site plan reviews. These are ones that don't have a ton of subjectivity, but that do require that public input. So an example of ministerial, like broadly, might be a sign permit where you have your review criteria would be, say, it has to be set back X feet from the road, it can be no higher than X feet tall, and the square footage of the sign face can be X square feet, right? But if your sign code said that the sign has to be in keeping with the character of the neighborhood, then you'd have to send it out for public comment because that's subjective, and 10 people in the same room would have a different interpretation of the keeping of the neighborhood. So I hope that helps explain it. Again, any questions so far?
Okay. I think the flowchart Daisy put together is super helpful.
Yeah, and we have it right up here. This explains the process that we go through for each of these. So the ministerial zoning permit, not a land use decision. Someone comes in, they fill out a permit, and the planner makes the final decision. There's no opportunity for the public to provide input. The administrative land use decision process, and this ORS that's referenced explains how the state views land use decisions. And their definitions of it. And these include administrator review, land partitions, property line adjustments, minor variances, which require some level of subjectivity. The process requires currently a 30-day completeness period, and then the planner writes findings, responds to the code criteria, sends notice out to the any affected agencies and neighboring property owners. Then we provide a 21-day comment period where anyone can request a hearing at that time, anyone with standing, and then the planner sends the final notice of decision, and then there's a 15-day appeal period. So that we'll get into that piece a little bit later, but it doesn't need to be that like protracted. And then the quasi-judicial process is where we come to the Planning Commission with things that require that higher level of subjectivity, where it's not just interpretation of a discretionary standard, but it really requires the application of professional interpretation. Okay, any questions on that piece? Okay. So in our code, zoning permits are the ministerial permit. So this is the over-the-counter permit. Different jurisdictions call them different things, but for us, this is our way of just verifying the clear and objective standards for any given development action. So if it's allowed outright and it only requires clear and objective standards, setbacks, building heights, those really basic, it's allowed use, that's done just through a zoning permit. It doesn't require a land use process. The second piece, though, and this is something that we use a zoning permit for, and it's really important because, and this is going to be kind of a theme of our discussion, I think, is that our code primarily conceptualizes rural development. It's a farm use or, a farm dwelling or a residential building shop on a residential lot. And, of course, we've realized that we're in over our heads in some ways when it comes to large-scale industrial development to the scale that we've seen in recent years. And we've recognized, we've kind of used our, like, interpretation and our, like, reading of the ORS to kind of tell people, like, yeah, I know our code says it's a zoning permit, but because we require discretion, we're going to have to send it out for notice. And so we're trying to make our code as in line with that process as possible, while also making sure that we're bringing the voices into the room about how this actually impacts those large-scale developments that our code doesn't really, like, plan for. So in this case, we sort of had two different options that we considered. And the first was to just make it two separate processes. You have either the ministerial process or the administrative process. And these really complex developments would go through the site plan review administrative process. And the, like, lower level development that can be clear and objective would just be a zoning permit. And the primary difficulty that we had with that was that we have to have some trigger for confirming that all these conditions of approval were met. So even if we're going through this more complex process, if we say you need to build this street, you need to, you know, put in this large scale, like, industrial wastewater pond, you need to, these things that maybe aren't necessarily within our, like, they're requiring other jurisdictions to approve, things that are really complex. We need to have that trigger to be able to say, okay, were your conditions of approval met? And our zoning permit has been that that process. And so where we've landed is that we want to have these large-scale developments go through the site plan review process, where we're reviewing their site plan, we're sending it out for comments, we're giving, we're preparing findings. And then after they receive that approval with their conditions of approval, when they're ready to build it, before they go in for building permits, they need to come back to us and get a zoning permit that verifies those clear and objective standards and makes sure that they've met all of their conditions of approval. And then we can give them the final check mark.
An analogy is on the building inspector side, you submit your site plans, the building inspector reviews pieces along the way, and the final piece is the certificate of occupancy. So our final piece is that zoning permit that says, mm-hmm. yep, you've checked all these boxes.
Yeah.
And then you're vested in our opinion, which is another topic we're going to touch on.
Yeah. And one way that we actually, that this comes into play a lot is the DEQ requires us to sign a LUX form, land use compatibility statement, and we can't do that until after we've received that preliminary approval. So we'll go through that approval process, which would be the site plan review in this under this amendment. We'll go through the site plan review, then we can sign off on their LUX, and then DEQ can go through their whole process of determining site suitability and soil, like, classifications and these more in-depth processes that aren't in our bailiwick, and then we can get that once they receive that final DEQ approval, they've checked the condition of approval, we see, okay, you're good to go, you can develop what you need to develop, and then we can sign off on the zoning permit. So, yeah. So these are the six factors that we've identified as triggering that subjective process. So the first one is kind of the broadest category, and there's two different ways that we can handle this, but a lot of our specific uses require some level of discretion to review the specific standards or limitations that have been adopted for that use. So an example might be, if you go to page 90 of your packet, you can see maybe 84. Page 83 and 84, this is where in the EFU zone, there's a whole list of uses allowed outright. And right now, the way that our code is drafted, it's just everything from like a farm use, which would be a zoning permit, or it might say dwelling customarily provided in conjunction with a farm use subject to section D18 and E. So if you go to like section E, you've got all these use standards that we need to review under subjective and discretionary criteria. And it's really not intuitive to say that, because we would just tell someone, oh yeah, you need to go through a land use decision in order to get approval for those uses that are subject to specific standards. In this case, it would be specifically identified in the code that those discretionary standards require that higher level of review. The second piece is, and this is actually broken out this way to kind of give us a jumping off point for discussion, and it provided this alternative way that we can break it off where we actually say these are the standards that are subject to just a zoning permit, and these are the ones that are subject to administrative review, site plan review. And that's one way we can do it, or we can just include under the administrative triggers that, hey, anything that identifies another subjective standard just has to go through administrative review. So the second piece is one that's come up a lot, and that's development that requires a TIA. So if you look in like the port industrial zone, data centers are allowed outright, but we know that they all pretty much trigger that TIA 400 trips per day.
Which is a traffic impact analysis.
Yeah,
you've seen.
So that's a super subjective process where we need to figure out whether the street system is consistent with the development they're proposing. It requires a pretty high level of professional discretion, input from engineers, and we just can't do that over a ministerial permit. At the very least, it needs to be an administrative review where we're sending it out for notice, we're providing findings, and we're analyzing with that higher level of discretion the impacts of their traffic impacts. The third one is development that uses municipal services outside of a UGB. And I think the specific language of this one needs to be workshopped a little bit, because we're really trying to get at a specific situation that's come up where a development is requiring water and sewer from a city or from a municipality, and it has to go across county land outside of a UGB to serve a development. And once you get into that, it opens a whole can of worms when it comes to goal exceptions and our job gets a little bit more complicated. So even if they do have a goal exception, we have to have a trigger that says we need to make sure that what you're proposing is consistent with the goal exception that you have approved. So that's just one that we know opens up a can of worms, and so we need to include that as... But I think that the specific language needs to be workshopped to get at that specific situation. Number four, development within specific overlay zones that require subjective or discretionary standards, and those were the airport overlay,
the speedway overlay zone.
Yeah, the floodplain
overlay zone.
And once you get into those overlays, we have that level of discretion to send out for notice. The significant resource overlay zone, airport safety and compatibility, and floodplain overlay.
Roland Percheron, you just approved that not long ago. That has an overlay zone, limited use overlay for that specific development.
Right. And again, remember, when we talk about the administrative triggers, this isn't a huge complex process. It's just the process that's required for us to apply any level of discretion. And it's a pretty straightforward process. Development that includes new roads. This is a new one that we're talking about, and that is just because our road standards in Article 4 are super subjective, and so once you're putting in either a private street outside of an urban growth boundary or a public street, it just requires us to apply these discretionary standards. That one makes sense. And then applications that include variances, and that's just so that you don't have my house is approved with a zoning permit, and my variance is approved through a whole separate process, that way it just bumps the whole development up to that administrative review. Okay, so any questions so far? That was the toughest part to get through, so. Okay, language clarity and consistent terminology. This one's pretty straightforward. The three primary ones were replacing county court with Board of Commissioners and removing reference to the Secretary of the Planning Commission, which was a position that no longer exists, was removed in 2017 from the bylaws. And then removing reference to site development review, which was in the past a way that was that large developments were reviewed, but there was a holdover throughout the code.
And the Planning Commission, a year and a half or 2 years ago, removed that section, but there were some pieces where it's still referenced. So this is cleaning that up.
Yeah, so just cleaning it up. Yeah. And then, go back. I included this as an option, just because it's like a jumping off point for a discussion again, is to talk about removing some of the obsolete zones that aren't being used and maybe have a lot of like duplication with other zones, such as the resource-related industrial zone or the speedway overlay. And those, if we do end up moving in that direction, it'll be done in conjunction with anyone who would be affected by that. But at this point, we're not recommending the removal of those. It might happen in a later code update. This amendment references section 10.030, which currently has a whole code enforcement provision that breaks down like the fees, the criminal penalties, the like options for rectifying a nuisance. But we in 2021 adopted a whole code enforcement ordinance, so this just references that so that we're consistent, and that's what we've used to do code enforcement in the past. These are two specific changes that are kind of like assorted changes. But the first one is the conversion of an existing farm-related dwelling to a non-farm dwelling. So this is language that we've adopted from like the Umatilla County Code. And the way that they do it is they say, you know what, basically, if you have a farm dwelling that the ground that that house is sitting on is not available for farming, there's no reason why we wouldn't allow you to convert it to a non-farm dwelling. And, a lot of people want to do that for estate planning purposes and other reasons. And if you no longer are a farmer or you want to retire and do something else, the conversion of that farm dwelling to a non-farm dwelling would basically, the way that it's written, that you would be allowed to do that as long as it meets all the criteria of the non-farm dwelling, except for that bit that it has to be like unfarmable ground because that's met by the fact that there's a house on it.
So I'll just add that I have noticed that our code in a few places are more restrictive than we have to be. So Daisy borrowed this language from Umatilla County. I think we need to tweak it just a little bit. I mean, we went back and forth with Dan a little bit today, but the intent is, we used to call this the homestead provision. So you have a farm, the folks want to stay at the farm and sell the rest of the property, or somebody else builds on the rest of the farm. This allows you to convert that. And back in the day when I was here originally, we used to approve those, and something got removed from the code. Just checked with the state. It's allowable. This will go as a package to the state when we send it to you for a formal hearing, probably in July, to make sure we have that language. There are some examples out there, and people are like, can't I do this? And we looked at our code, well, no, you can't, but I think you can if we make this code amendment. It still doesn't, I don't think we're going to see a broad brush of these throughout the county, but it is a good estate planning tool for people who want to have that. And that doesn't preclude anybody from keeping it in the same ownership and maybe refinancing the house. Apart from the farm ground, you probably know a lot about that if you deal with farm ground. I've seen people do this and then recombine them. So they have a home loan on the house and a farm loan on the property. And then when it's all solved, they can recombine them. It's just a nice estate planning tool. And again, the state needs to make sure they like our language so we're not being rogue out there.
Okay, and then accessory structures. So this piece was actually the shipping containers. We get a lot of these, like people want to just put shipping containers on their property as an accessory structure. And the Board of Commissioners, like years ago, adopted this or approved this language that would allow like certain standards for shipping containers. And this is a good case study for what we were just talking about, administrative versus ministerial, because this is the language that was adopted. And then I added no more than 2 shipping containers on a single lot because we felt like that was reasonable. But the way that they had it worded on number 3 is that shipping containers shall be painted to visually conform with surrounding local environment, including the concealment of any company logos and or container nomenclature. So by having that standard in there, any shipping container is going to have to go out for notice, and we're going to have to provide findings showing that it's in conformance with that, with the subjective standards of the zone. And so this is like a good way to talk about this. We're fine with adopting this way. I don't think there's anything wrong with sending out notice to the neighbors in case they disagree about this visual conformance standard. I think that's fine. But in doing so, it's kind of a good way to talk about, the ministerial versus administrative when that comes into play. So the next piece is clarifying the extensions and vesting requirements. So we're not changing any of the expiration dates. Site plan review and CUP approvals will be valid for 2 years. Dwellings in farm and forest zones will be valid for 4 years, same as they are currently. Zoning permits are valid for 1 year. And currently, there's no limit to the number of extensions that the planning department can grant. And extensions are actually approve it under like subjective criteria where the applicant will have to show.
Are we still recording?
Okay.
Can Zoom still hear us?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks, Liz.
Perfect.
That's weird.
Yeah, that was weird. So currently we can grant as many extensions as is requested, but they're done under subjective criteria where they have to show that there was reasons that stopped them from being able to start their development, and they have to show that in some cases that they've done 10% of the development or other things like that. And so the way we're changing it, we were informed by our land use council that by having subjectivity there, it has to go out for the administrative process, which is an option. But this is, I guess, again, just a starting point for discussion that we've recommended just allowing a 1 year clear and objective extension. So basically anyone who applies for it before their site plan review or CUP has expired can get it. It's just again, clear and objective, check the box, you get the extension. How it's worded now, we're only allowing one year extension, which I think is like not, like that's pretty atypically restrictive. What we can do is, I think the best way to go with it would be to either allow unlimited extensions as long as they meet our clear and objective standard, which include that the code hasn't changed since your approval, or we can allow those second, third, fourth extensions to go through the administrative process and show that they've met subjective criteria.
And this is one, as members of the representative of the community, you might want to think about. So typically this is a non-issue, but if you have a controversial issue and something's permitted, and you have neighbors or a neighborhood who doesn't like it, and it gets approved anyway, that means those neighbors are lingering out there for maybe years before that development transpires. And so there's some value in putting an end in it to say, no more than 2 years. If you go beyond 2 years, you're going to start the process over again. Because it might mean you can or cannot sell your house, for example, or whatever your investment is going on. And the reverse is also true. Right, so if you are vested and you have your permit approval, we don't want people gaming the system. Not suggesting anybody is currently doing that, but it has been done. Hey, let's just entitle a piece of property and get all the permits, and we sit on it for 10 years. The process was never intended to work that way. So I really like the idea of a clear and objective. You've got X number of years, and after that, then you can start the process over. And nobody ever wants to start the process over, particularly if it's a lengthy, you've seen some of those in the past couple of years, really time-consuming application.
Yeah. So vesting. And yeah, I think if anyone has like questions on clarification between like vesting and extensions, like vesting means that you don't need an extension anymore, you're good to go. It's like solidified or cemented that decision. Extensions mean it's still hanging out there, you haven't started the development yet, and you can get it extended. And so that's why, so extensions, you can only get them if the code hasn't changed. So if our code's changed and we've updated standards to be in line with state law, we can't just grant an extension for 10 years to keep it going. But the vesting piece of it, if it's vested, so for example, if you want to build, say you get an approval for 10 houses, and that's a bad example because there's no you could get approval for 10 houses, but if you did, and then you only built one of them, could the other nine come into play a year from now or 10 years from now? The way our code is done right now, you kind of could. Like you could build the first one, and you're kind of good to go for eternity on the other nine. And that's where the vesting piece is important to think about too. Right now we have it so that if you've got a zoning permit, that vests your land use decision, your site plan review, or your conditional use permit. And then the zoning permit is vested when you get a building permit approval. Okay. Are there questions there?
It gets complicated when you have phased development. So, and we always are erring on the side of the developer. I know not everybody believes that, but we are. and the community, right? Our job is to balance those two interests. But we would never want to see a developer unnecessarily go through a application twice if they don't need to. So if there's an approval for, say, a phased development like a hunting lodge and they want 20 cabins, but they only build 4 in the first year and they're vested, we want to be careful with our original approval language, and something like that would probably go to the Planning Commission. So yes, you can do that, and you're vested with those first 4, and probably with the rest if you come in subsequent years to get those, because your original approval was for 10.
Mm-hmm. Even if the code changes, even if state law
Even if the code changes, yeah. Yeah. Those are, we almost have to deal with on a case-by-case basis because they're kind of funny that way.
Yeah.
We good?
Yeah. Okay, so this piece of it is, I kind of alluded to earlier, but our administrative review process is it's a little bit more protracted than what state law requires. So currently, if someone submits an application today, we have 30 days to get back to them and request any additional information. And then once we've deemed it complete, we send out a tentative decision with findings. And that can take time to like draft that too. So it's not just the 21 days, but it, after we send out the decision, then we give people 3 weeks to provide comments and request a hearing if they want. If someone requests a hearing, we actually would send out an additional notice that, hey, it's going to a hearing on this day. And then after the whole process is done, and we've incorporated everyone's comments and gone through the hearing if it's requested, then we'd send out the notice of final decision, and then there's a 15-day appeal period. And so we found that that's kind of unnecessary because we haven't really had situations where people, didn't hear about it in the first comment period and then want to appeal it in the second, or, you know, that's not really an issue. People who want to comment are going to comment. And so it just ends up kind of creating a lot more staff work to do these two separate decision processes. And so we can keep it that way, or if you want to click the next slide, this draft incorporates language that was recommended by a developer to say we can just cut out the first notice, the first comment period, and the request for hearing, and we can just send out our final decision and findings. And if we get comments back during that 15-day appeal period, we can send it to a hearing. They can request a de novo hearing, which means it's just like a regular public hearing where anyone can provide testimony. If people recommend changes, we can make those changes, even though it's a like final decision. We always have the option to like make adjustments. And so we had a lot of questions about this, but I think it makes a lot of sense to basically consolidate those two pieces. And we can extend that 15-day appeal period. It doesn't have to be just 15 days if we want to sort of have that compromise to give people plenty of time, but without having this two-phased approach. We can make it as, we can do a 21-day appeal period, we can do a 12-day appeal period, I think is the minimum. And the next slide breaks that down too. So it would basically be, this is the current process, how we had it lined out on that flowchart. And then if you click the second button, that this would eliminate that second set of things. And this would be the second option, would be to allow a 21-day appeal period instead of a 15-day.
Well, and it's a bit of a misnomer to call it an appeal period, because with an administrative process, it's a request for a hearing, and state law limits the fee for that. It's been hotly debated. It's been $250 since I can remember. So over 30 years, it's been $250, which means that a reasonable person with reasonable means could afford a $250 request for a public hearing. And we could, where it says on the left-hand side, notice is sent, the 21-day comment period, and it says may request a hearing. That's also true on the right-hand side. So notice is sent to agencies and property owners with an opportunity to request a hearing. Yeah. And once a hearing's requested, that comes to you, and it becomes a quasi-judicial review.
And we always have the ability to elevate an administrative decision to the Planning Commission, just if we feel like it's appropriate. That's always been incorporated into our code. And so if someone brings up an issue that we didn't consider, even if they're not formally requesting an appeal, we can take that option to go back to and say, hey, we didn't consider this, or there's additional criteria we didn't include, and we can elevate it through that process as well if we feel like it's appropriate.
Yeah, and that's fairly universal. Most counties that I've interacted with have that option. At the onset of the application, the director has the authority to bump it up to Planning Commission, even if it's an administrative decision. We don't do that lightly, but sometimes we get applications and we know it's going to be controversial. Just send it to the Planning Commission. Everybody gets a fair shot. Nobody has to go out of their way to, you know, request a hearing. And then the burden of proof remains on the applicant. And we could also bump it up during the comment period. That's much less common. We usually ask one of those noticing agencies to do that. And by the way, if a decision goes out under administrative review, current or proposed, and we receive a lot of public comment and we have to significantly change our findings, we have to resend that notice. We don't play gotcha to somebody who said, well, you know, that's what I read, and then y'all went and changed it however much. We have to, it has to be pretty minor for us not to reissue that notice. So sometimes sending it to Planning Commission is more expedited than doing it administrative.
Great. Okay, so I think this is the final piece that we wanted to touch on was the CUP process. And so the Planning Commission had gone through, when you guys did the administrative review adoption, maybe Tamara wants to speak to that a little bit more, but
we goofed up. No, actually, we didn't goof, but there were a few pieces. So often you change one piece and it has, particularly if you're changing definitions or processes. So we needed to go back into individual zones and then go to Article 4 and Article 6 and Article 9.
Mm-hmm. But it brings up a good discussion, I think, because, you know, a lot of the CUPs, the CUP process is the only quasi-judicial, like, development approval process in our code.
That automatically goes to you.
Yeah. So,
and that list on the left, that always goes to you.
Both of these, yeah. But these are all examples of identified uses in different zones that, always go to the Planning Commission through the quasi-judicial process. And so I think it's worth discussing and just bring it up that, you know, we often see home occupations, residential uses in commercial zones, renewable energy facilities, aggregate mining operations. Those are like the four big ones. But our code also uses the CUP process to approve a golf course in an EFU zone, a sewage treatment facility in a residential zone, personal use airports in the EFU zone, a hospital in the SR zone, mobile home parks, those things that I think do belong in the quasi-judicial process. And so I think by bringing it back up again to be able to say, I think that if there are specific CUP uses that we feel aren't appropriate to go to the Planning Commission, I think it makes more sense to bump those down to an administrative allowed outright, rather than bumping all CUPs down to administrative review.
So administrative review most commonly is a farm dwelling or a non-farm dwelling in EFU zone. We do, I don't know how many a year, but we do quite a few of those. I think you used to see all of those, and now we process those administratively, and they're pretty straightforward. Same as a land partition. Land partition is really straightforward unless you've got some really tricky access or easement requirements that might also require a variance, and we would send it to you. Subdivisions always come to the Planning Commission. We don't do very many full subdivisions, they're mostly land partitions. For replats, replats we can do.